Hello and welcome to Shared Decision Making and Motivational Interviewing in the Care of Patients with HBV, HCV, and HDV. I'm your avatar host, Faye Jackson. This activity is supported by an educational grant from Gilead Sciences Incorporated. Please note this program was recorded prior to the November 2025 liver meeting held in Washington, D.C. In today's program, you'll hear from six renowned experts in viral hepatitis, including co-chairs Su Wong of the United States and Heiner Wedemeyer of Germany, as well as faculty panelists Jean-Michel Polatsky of France, Maria Booty of Spain, George Lau of Hong Kong, and Debika Bhattacharya of the United States.
My name is Dr. Su Wong, and I'm the medical director for viral hepatitis programs and the Center for Asian Health at Cooperman Barnabas Medical Center, which is in New Jersey, USA.
I'm George. I'm George Lau. I graduated from the University of Hong Kong in 1987. I have been working as a hepatologist for more than 30 years, and I also work in China. I'm a chair professor in Beijing and also Shanghai, and I operate my private clinical trial center now in Hong Kong and working on advancements of drug discoveries and so on in liver diseases. And in addition, so in the past few years, we set up the Aposo Viral Elimination Task Force, and I was elected as the chairman. And now, right now, I'm working on the guidelines for Aposo, chronic hepatitis B, with a lot of friends in Asia-Pacific regions, more than 48 members from 26 countries or special administrative regions.
My name is Heiner Wedemeyer. I have the privilege to chair the Department of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, Infectious Diseases, and Endocrinology here at Hanover Medical School in Germany. And at this center, we had a long interest in liver diseases, but in particular in viral hepatitis.
My name is Jean-Michel Pavlutsky. I'm a hepatologist by training. I became a virologist by profession and doing both jobs together as well as I could. Currently, I'm the head of the Department of Biology and Pathology in the Henri Mondor University Hospital, which is one of the major university hospitals in the Paris area. And I'm also head of a research unit related to INSERM, our National Institute for Health. And the title of our research unit is Viruses, Hepatology, Cancer. So we're right in the right topic.
I am Maria Booty. I am a hepatologist based in Barcelona, in Spain, in a Hospital Universitario Vallebrón. And I have been working in the field of viral hepatitis for many, many years, particularly in screening, diagnosis, linkage to care, and treatment for hepatitis B, C, and Delta.
My name is Debika Bhattacharya. I'm a physician scientist who does infectious diseases, and I'm based here at UCLA in the great state of California in the United States. And my work is largely around directing a viral hepatitis program in a large integrated healthcare system. And then my research is focused on HIV and viral hepatitis co-infection, primarily HIV and Hep B co-infection, and with a focus on pregnancy and outcomes within pregnancy. However, we do a lot of hepatitis C screening, linkage to care, and treatment in our setting, and I'm really excited to be able to talk to you all about it today.
And now, let's join Dr. Su Wong and Dr. George Lau as they explore the role of shared decision-making in viral hepatitis.
So what do you, like, if you get a patient who's, like, young, in their 20s, what is your conversation like with them? Hepatitis B, I mean, is it different if they have really high viral load, you know, and they're in that state where they're immune tolerant versus, like, you know, E negative?
That's an excellent question. We have very lengthy discussions last time, and I think we are going to get rid of the so-called immune tolerance definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we have also data from China with my colleagues, Professor Wang Fuseng, very close friends, that younger children, if they start therapy, they have a better response.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting data. And I think as a as a parent, you would say, yeah, if you could treat my, you know, less than 7-year-old and there's some chance they can lose their surface antigen and live without Hep B for the rest of their life, that's worth it. You know, an oral pill that's safe. I think we need to have more conversations on pediatrics in younger patients, especially if we can avoid the integration. And the other thing I want to bring up is, like, you know, with parents, there's a lot of, you know, in young people, there's stigma, right? And there's fear of transmission. You know, how do you incorporate that when you talk to your patients? Like, do you talk about, let's start the virus? You know, it's not just to prevent cirrhosis, but it can also help prevent transmission too.
It shouldn't be a stigma anymore. And I think that all the occupational restrictions, which happens, frankly, 20, 30 years ago, so mostly are.
At least in China, this is not all around the world. I mean, there are a lot of places that that restrict travel, like visas. You can't get visas in certain countries if you have hepatitis B.
That's not visas, immigrations. If you talk about they allow you to travel, but not to immigrate. Because
can I immigrate and maybe you know, get a job?
The health course burden.
But
with the, as I said, with the availability of the generics, the prices less than 1% of the original one, more than it's less than 1%, and I think that we know how to manage the patients. If you are service hospital, if you get pregnant, so we have special measures to help and to prevent perinatal transmissions, and that helps your next generations. This is very important. Also, your sexual partners could be protected.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like HIV.
Do you find patients want to talk to you about this? Because we find that a lot of there's a lot of discussion in patient groups about this. Like, how do I tell my new boyfriend? You know, I'm really worried. Like, I cut myself at home. Like, do I need to clean with bleach? Like, but I find it with doctors, patients are not always telling us their real concerns. Right? They don't tell us about stigma and discrimination, but it weighs heavily on them. I don't know if you've had that experience also.
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. But when you have a boyfriend or girlfriend and you want to disclose your hepatitis B or not, I think he is already infected by that time. So it's
you bring up that point. It's already done. Right. It's not
before
it's
you
not
come
an
to the stage
of an easy conversation
of
to have. Right. And so
it's not relevant because most of them. My experience of all those spouse or with a relationship, they are already they already have natural immunity.
Yeah, right. So if they have a good healthy immune system, they oftentimes you test them and they're core positive, surface antibody positive, right?
That's right.
But it's interesting. Hep B is so interesting because sometimes I test people and you expect them to be core positive and some of them don't. Some of them never get infected or for some reason don't get, I don't know. The virus is very interesting, right? And it might be viral load, genotype. Some people you expect it, but I think generally you're right. In households, we do find that people become exposed and then they become immune. But this is why it's so important to get vaccinated, right? Once somebody's vaccinated, you don't have to worry about these things. So I think that's a real success of it. So I think that art of medicine, you know, bringing the patient in, the shared decision-making is really part of this whole new, you know, approach to hepatitis B and opening, you know, expanding care.
Next, Dr. Wong discusses patient engagement and motivational interviewing with Dr. Maria Budi of Barcelona, Spain.
So I'm going to move on to our next topic, which is about patient engagement and shared decision making and the use of motivational interviewing. We know, you know, for a lot of these, for hepatitis B, C, and Delta, there are unique needs in the populations, and a lot of them are marginalized populations that we've talked about. And the trick, especially for the chronic infections, really is keeping people in long-term care, right? A lot of times, especially if they don't have cirrhosis or other symptoms. What have you found to be most useful in engaging patients to keep them in care, especially if people face stigma or have other competing health and social challenges? You know, we know a lot of these populations have issues with language or insurance, although in Spain it might be different with your health insurance. But what are some things that you guys do to keep your patients in care?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most important topics currently, because in a country with Spain or or another European countries with a public health system that covers screening, diagnosis, and treatment, the hot issue is linkage to care, mm-hmm. particularly for vulnerable populations or populations that have, as you have mentioned, barriers such as language barriers or even people that don't like to access to our healthcare systems for stigma or because their diseases are registered in the healthcare systems and they don't like to have this type due to stigma or other issues. So what are we doing? We are doing community programs. We have several community programs in different settings, in migrations, in centers, when these migrants arrive at the first consultation in some centers. In consulates, we have running here in Barcelona a screening program in Pakistan consulate that is very useful, another one from our Romanian people because the prevalence of hepatitis delta in Romania is very high. And also we are running programs in addiction centers or in specific places. So I think this is good to identify patients for screening, but then the second step is linkage to care. Uh-huh. To facilitate linkage to care with a direct contact with the different centers that are diagnosing and treatment and given treatment for viral hepatitis. And also we use some apps, some mobile applications that we can give to the patients. And they can contact and they can modify visits. It's a direct
contact. Wow, that's amazing.
Center. So this is very nice because people use by WhatsApp. Mm-hmm. They can communicate with us. And this is, I think, it's a good idea that it's easy to do. We copy this from our hospital for strokes. And we apply it now for viral hepatitis, and it's very useful.
So this is great to hear some of the innovations that are happening in Spain. So we're going to talk about this. Kind of ties into kind of the how we interact with patients one on one, especially with the different like cultural factors, and like kind of focusing on shared decision making, which is. Was actually very central to the EASL guidelines, which I think the community was very happy to see. Just the recognition that we should be looking at patient preferences and values when we talk about initiating treatment for Hep B, and then also for Hep C. This comes up, obviously in terms of whether people are ready to start treatment or not. So, how do you incorporate that shared decision-making into treatment discussions for hepatitis B? As we know, patients are very different, in how they think of their infections.
Yeah. We try to, at first, we have nurses working with us, particularly for hepatitis B. For hepatitis C, not anymore, because the treatment is so easy and don't need explanations, the majority. The only thing for hepatitis C that I think is still important to discuss, particularly when we treat drug addicts, it's the risk of reinfection. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people forget this, and people think that when they are cured, there is no risk of reinfection, but I think this is very important to explain the risk of reinfection, because we have several patients that have been reinfected 3 or 4 times. So very important to explain. On hepatitis B, I think it's more important to have co-workers doing it. Patients, and they understand not only the need of continuous monitoring, mm-hmm. there is no cure. These patients need to be monitoring and need to to continue with treatment for long, long time, because it's very difficult to reach functional cure. We are also very, very active in clinical trials. So we try to explain the patients the possibility to access to a clinical trial and to have the opportunity to test new drugs and sometimes the possibility of achieving a functional cure. And because we have this huge migrant population, we have also language barriers. Problems with health literacy. And then we use interpreters and also culturally adapted materials. So we have materials, particularly in Urdu or in language that we have more migrants that help to explain. And also we are now translating this app that we have to different language. And in the worst circumstance, we use Google to try
the translation.
It's the only way to understand, because some of these people don't speak Spanish. But sometimes the only way to communicate is using a Google translator or call to a friend that translates everything.
Yeah, we have we have video translators. So it's like on the iPad and we just hit a button and then somebody pops up on the other side, video or sometimes just phone call. But sometimes if you don't have that, or if like you're trying to just translate a technical word, then the Google Translate is really helpful. So I don't know if you have, this is amazing that you have a team basically that can help with hepatitis B. Do you guys talk about motivational interviewing with patients in terms of kind of making sure they understand? I think one of the tricks is, you know, we talk, and then you don't know how much the patient actually hears or understands. And I know in residency, they used to train a lot of the residents in motivational interviewing. I don't know if that's something that they do in Europe as well.
Yeah, it's very heterogeneous. I think probably like US, Europe, it's very heterogeneous. It's heterogeneous between countries and also between different centers. They are centers very well motivated with specific programs, with videos, with people dedicated to viral hepatitis. And there are other centers that there is less motivation and less tools to reach these vulnerable populations that I think now are the key populations for both for hepatitis B and Delta. So the thing is that it's extremely, extremely heterogeneous. Heterogeneous in everything. Because we are working, I am working with a team very motivated with a long tradition. We usually try, particularly in difficult cases, to have two visits. One with a physician and another with a nurse.
Amazing.
Yeah, because I think it's the way that they can understand better the disease. Can understand better the need of continuous treatment. And also in the app, we can send to the patients reminders for medication. They have access to educational videos that sometimes are important. And they have this easy way to communicate with us through our WhatsApps.
That's really amazing. I think one of the things that I find, I have navigators, I don't have a nurse, but I find that my patient navigators who work with the patient right when they're diagnosed, if they're diagnosed, we have the emergency room screening. So they talk to the patient before the patient even comes to see me. And they often get so much more information than I do, like about the patient, right? I feel like the patients are more open to sharing things with them that they don't always tell a doctor, right? Like they're embarrassed or They don't want the doctor to know about, you know, if they have unstable family situation, or if they can't drive, or if they have to work late, or they have kid, you know, childcare issues. They don't tell us that. And so I think it's important for somehow we have to get these things out because they're barriers to care, obviously. And then I think the other thing that's going to come up with the whole like patient preferences of values, like stigma and discrimination, they often don't tell us these things, but it's important to know because that can also be a barrier to care, or it can be a reason that they want treatment, right? Their labs may look okay, but they may feel so much shame, or they may live in close quarters with household contacts and they're worried about spreading hepatitis B to their family members. So I think with a focus on shared decision-making, we as providers have to make sure we can elicit these priorities from patients and find out if there are other reasons that they want to be treated, not just their ALT or their viral load or liver cancer.
Before we continue, let's get our audience involved. Which of the following is most consistent with a motivational interviewing approach when engaging patients with chronic HBV, HCV, or HDV? Is it A, you need to start treatment soon? Do you understand why? B, why haven't you been coming to your clinic visits regularly? You can do this. C, what concerns or priorities do you have as you think about starting treatment? D, are you ready to start treatment today or not? Or choose E if you're not sure. And the answer is C. What concerns or priorities do you have as you think about starting treatment? And now, let's return to Dr. Sue Wong and Dr. Maria Booty.
So I find myself asking more now, you know, asking like, what do you think of treatment? You know, are you worried about transmission? You know, so I think that's going to be a shift, you know, where we really try to bring the patient to the table and find out, you know, how does Hep B impact your life?
Yeah. You are completely right. I think it's the same in Spain. I think patients are more confident and explain more things to navigators or to a nurse than to the doctor. And usually, a nurses have more time. They spend more time. They visit the patients after the medical visit. So patients, if they have some doubts,
and they ask that question,
I think they ask more to the nurses than to physicians. And as you mentioned, we also have an important emergency department program.
Yeah, you have it too, right?
From screening for viral hepatitis. And we did very similar that you have explained. When we identify a patient with antibodies, anti-HCV antibodies, or HBs antigen positive, we are doing automatically reflex testing for if it's anti-HCV positive for viremia, if he or she is HBs antigen positive, then we are doing HBV DNA and anti-delta antibodies. Then we check all the medical registers, and if we think this person is not linked to care, or it's not a candidate because they have comorbidity or very low life expectancy, because sometimes in the emergency department patients have short life expectancy, we don't call them. But if we think they are good candidates, we call them for an appointment and a medical visit, and the acceptance of this program is very good. And we catch a lot of migrants and vulnerable population that usually don't attend the primary care physicians, but when they don't feel very well, they go to the emergency department. So I think it's also a good program.
Thank you, Dr. Wong and Dr. Booty. Now let's join Dr. Wedemeyer and Dr. Polotsky for additional European perspectives.
And that leads me to the main point, because a patient with viral hepatitis needs time.
Yeah.
They need to explain the disease, and obviously if you have to teach students or young fellows these days, important point is patient engagement and shared decision making. You have to involve your patient. And I think for the GPs, if you really want to involve your patient, you need knowledge and expertise also in the details. And that's probably our jobs, the experts, to explain the importance of a viral hepatitis or an infection and with all the consequences behind that. I don't know, at least for me in Germany, this is really an issue. And patients who are infected with the hepatitis virus, they have questions. I assume that's the same in France, right?
Yeah, they have questions. I mentioned already the cultural barriers, which are problematic. I think the thing we did well in France is that the country has been organized in regional networks for viral hepatitis.
Yeah.
There is always a hepatology university hospital hepatology center, but many other hospital centers and some private physicians and some general practitioners. And this is always linked to a virology lab, to local health clinics, opioid substitution clinics, prison clinics, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the networking has been something very helpful in finding the patients, in linking them to care and bringing them to cure or control for B or D. But again, I insist on the cultural barriers. The patients we see now are not the same as the ones we saw 20 years ago when we had this huge amount of hepatitis C patients coming from transfusion many years before. I mean, now the majority of new patients we diagnose, they are younger, they have less severe disease, and they are very often migrants born in other countries or prisoners or people inject drugs. So we have to deal with these very specific populations, and this is where an important point is multidisciplinary approaches. We need teams, we need networking, we need several professionals, healthcare workers to work together in a complementary way. And I think one thing that may help you, I know that everybody would speak about it, but one thing that may help you is artificial intelligence. Because the new tools, the digital tools already help. Telemedicine helps as well. I guess artificial intelligence can be very helpful in these situations, and I hope that some of our younger friends and colleagues will invest in this, because this is probably the next challenge. Find innovative tools to help us in this path to diagnose patients, to link them to care, and to treat them and get to some treatment success. This is true for B, for D, and for C.
And probably also on different levels, AI, first of all, to identify patients and clusters to characterize disease, but also to educate the patients, right? So I want to have the Jean-Michel Pavlovsky avatar for my patient that he can talk to the virtual Jean-Michel, explaining him or her the consequences of an infection.
That's the fantasy of immortality, right?
But seriously, I think for other diseases, we have apps that are interactive. For other diseases, this is reality, in particular for risk groups and in particular for the cultural barriers that you just mentioned. This may be really an important thing, probably not something we have been used to, but I'm pretty confident that this will be part of medicine for many diseases, and for viral hepatitis, this may have a particular role. I think it's an important point, really.
I think this is really something for EASL, ASLD to take care of. It's a mission of scientific societies to think, but not only to think, but to act as well. So maybe having a HEP-GPT would be something interesting. So we can suggest that to them, actually. Because we see in our everyday practice, I don't know you, Heiner, but I personally use ChatGPT more and more. It's very good. It's very helpful. And I think it's very, very suited to medicine. for the doctors as a help, but for the patients as well. And so there is something to do here.
Next up, Dr. Wedemeyer is joined by Dr. Debika Bhattacharya.
We need different types of information. We need different types of, let's say, talking to patients.
That's really interesting. You know, one point that I really love that you've brought this up, Rainer, because I think this really highlights, I'm just going to put a plug in for research, of course, but I think this really highlights the need to really do behavioral sciences research, right? Where we understand what the patient's perspective is, because if we can't get folks to take medicine, then, you know, then what is the use of developing, you know, all of these great products that we have? So I just wanted to put a plug in for that. Yeah, you know, I think that's really interesting. For us, I think that in California, so hepatitis C and hepatitis B. In hepatitis B, it is true that those who are foreign born have a higher prevalence of hepatitis B in the state of California. Largely, I would say in my practice, large academic healthcare setting, most individuals are actually highly educated. They are coming as, you know, postdocs, working in the technology sector, and they're quite cognizant of the need to be screened. I think what becomes an interesting conversation is around treatment and the need for treatment in hepatitis B in particular. I think, you know, in the HIV community, obviously HIV is a different disease. Outcomes happened more quickly. You know, you must treat. But I think we have not seen the same amount of awareness like we did for HIV for hepatitis B, for example. And so kind of this acknowledgement that this is a chronic disease, it's a disease that at some point is likely going to need to be treated if they are not able to clear surface antigen by themselves. I think that is a new concept that really bears, you know, discussing. And treatment paradigms are evolving. And so not everybody has heard about, you know, expanded treatment for hepatitis B. And there is some reluctance, I will say, for people to get treated for hepatitis B. And I don't know if that's cultural. I don't have that knowledge to say that it's cultural or not. But I have noticed that I was surprised, actually, as I started talking more and more about expanded treatment for hepatitis B, that I was meeting more resistance to chronic therapy than I thought.
Let's join Dr. Wong and Dr. Lau one more time for additional perspectives from Asia.
So yeah, I think it's important to bring this up because, you know, I think when we look at the old studies and the old guidelines, you know, it's a different proposition now, right? Like when we looked at a lot of the original studies, we're talking about lamivudine and interferon and high resistance, right? We had a different mindset. It was a little bit more, you know, you could feel as a, that's like a scarcity mindset, right? You only want to treat the right people. Now we're saying, you know what? These drugs work. They're cheap. We know that they work for all phases. And now we also know more about integration of DNA, right? And how that can lead to mutation.
Yeah, safe. With a long record,
yes.
With a long record, at that time we are starting to have these medications. Now, 20 years down the road, we know they are safe.
Right. So I think we need to change our mindset to, instead of who should we treat, it's, hey, maybe we should be treating most everybody and like decide, and then being more picky about who not to treat, right? Yeah. Instead of prove that you need to be treated, you know, let's look at the patient and say, prove to me you don't need to be treated. And maybe treat them a little earlier to prevent fibrosis, right? I feel like some of the approaches, why, let's not wait until there's fibrosis. Maybe we can prevent fibrosis as long as the patient is willing, right? The patient has to be an equal partner because they're the ones that have to take the medication every day.
Thank you to our international faculty for your expertise and astute perspectives. And thank you, our global audience, for joining us. By way of summary, here are three SMART goals. SMART stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. SMART Goal 1, integrate at least 2 patient-centered strategies into hepatitis care discussions. SMART Goal 2, use at least 1 motivational interviewing technique, such as open-ended questions, to improve engagement and retention, especially in vulnerable populations. And 3, implement or reinforce workflows that include reflex testing and proactive follow-up as appropriate. Thank you and have a wonderful day.